bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 3, Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. But before we get into what we saw unfold over the weekend, it's the perfect time to remind you, go to FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard. Take advantage of all the generous sign-up bonuses they have available, whether it's a $1,000 risk-free free bet or 30-1 odds on tonight's Monday Night Football game between the Cowboys and Eagles for all new users. Be sure to read the stipulations, but it's a great way to get in the game if you don't have a strong conviction one way or another. Payne, another great Sunday of NFL football. It rarely disappoints, and maybe the crown jewel of all unfolded Sunday night.
I just had to check to see if my mic was plugged in. That would have been a fun 50 minutes if we recorded and I just wasn't actually.
Yeah, especially because I can't see if your mic or my mic is plugged in. I hear you coming through, but it would have been a little bit uncomfortable with people listening to me drone on and only getting one side of the conversation.
Sunday Night Football was pretty good. Obviously, the Packers got out to the quick start. I don't think that was overly shocking. The endgame situation there with San Francisco, you come away saying, we lost the game. We should have won it had we managed the clock a little bit better. Jimmy G snaps that ball on the touchdown to Juszczyk with 14 seconds left.
Suboptimal.
Not really sure what you were doing there. But at least you come away saying, Jimmy G's probably pretty confident right now. Something we hadn't seen in him, I think, the first couple weeks. Obviously, they went up and down the field on the Lions, but didn't look like he had a ton of confidence in him last week. Had a couple errors, miscues throughout the first 3.5-plus quarters against the Packers. But that was a big drive. You could kind of just tell. Like, all the weight was off his shoulders at that point. So I think that's going to be a positive moving forward, even though you didn't get the result you wanted here. And you would just hope that Kyle Shanahan in the future's a little bit better with that clock management in the late game situation.
What did you make of the way the 49ers elected to go about defending Green Bay in the final 37 seconds? The Packers had no timeouts. San Francisco could essentially open up the middle of the field. And I get the concept of playing zone, but at some point, you may want to put an extra body on Davante Adams.
Yeah, you should probably cover Davante Adams. Twice. So
one time I get one time, you know, if you want to get him to midfield, I get it, but two times, make somebody else on that Packers roster beat you.
And MVS was on the sideline, so you didn't have that additional deep threat to necessarily be worried about. You only had Davante Adams at that point and a bunch of possession receivers like a Randall Cobb or an Amari Rodgers. You got to at least make someone else beat you. Now, ridiculous throw, the first one, just right over the outstretched arms of the linebacker and before the safety. But the second one, that was just ridiculous. That was just pitch and catch in the backyard. So you have to come up with a little bit better plan of attack to defend Davante Adams in those situations, which was pretty poor.
I just don't get it. And again, it's an oversimplification from a simpleton like myself that goes, you know what, if we're going to lose this game, we're going to go down fighting and we're not going to let you beat us with the 99-mile-an-hour fastball. So play zone, allow them to pick up yardage in the middle of the field, but don't let Adams be the one that slips behind you. Alas, we've seen it time and time again. Green Bay able to sneak through, grab the 30-28 victory. Unfortunate for those of us with the 49ers win total who would have liked to steal one that didn't look like it was going to be possible when they faced a 17-0 deficit early in that game. As is always, Monday football tradition around the Bet the Board offices is the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I felt like Sunday Night Football, the perfect place to kick things off. But Payne, what did you see unfold yesterday that surprised you in a positive manner?
Well, I think when you start things out, the biggest game of the day for me, and it's one that I was glued to, is obviously Chiefs Chargers. And I thought there was some interesting stuff, at least early on in that game. it seems like, at least on the internet, everyone thinks the Chiefs are just absolutely done, like cooked. And that's not really what I see. It feels like there's a lot of just negative variance going on. Again, you know, you come back week one, it wasn't pretty against the Browns. And then you have Sunday Night Football where, again, you're up 11, 3 minutes to go with the ball at midfield in the third quarter. And then yesterday, the Chiefs came out with their hair on fire. I mean, everything that we broke down in the preview of that game came to fruition except the scoreboard. And we didn't anticipate three drives with turnovers ending them, right? Like, it just was very weird. The first three quarters, the only touchdown the defensive side of the ball gave up were on short fields. The defense, we talked about, like, hey, you could have like handpicked two worst offenses for Spags to face. That's who they faced in the first 2 weeks. And that this was going to be, that we'd see a little bit of an uptick. The Rams averaged 4.9 yards per play the first three quarters. The Chiefs were a plus 16 in net success rate over that stretch, right? They out-explosived the Rams 3-1.
Chargers, you mean? Chargers, right?
Yes. Sorry, the Chargers.
No worries.
3-1. The run defense that everyone just kind of like thought was a sieve allowed 2.5 a carry and a 33% success rate without a single explosive run in the first three quarters. And you're just looking at the Chiefs. They're still the most efficient passing team in the entire league right now. So that was the most interesting game to me. I thought there was a lot of positive to take away from the Chiefs in that situation. It wasn't necessarily good, but a huge win for the Chargers on the road, right? You're a 6.5-7 point dog. You go into Arrowhead, you kind of slay the dragon in the division, and you let them know that, hey, we're going to be here for a while. We got a young coach. We got a young coordinator. We got a young quarterback, and that this isn't your division. So you have like that huge, like, oof, we're here. And obviously the negative is that we saw Andy Reid have some complications after the game, ministered to the hospital. Let's see what that looks like. But I know you're pretty high on what the Chargers did in yesterday's game.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily high on all the X's and O's that we saw, because much like you, I didn't see the game unfold like a lot of people who went, oh, the Chargers were the dominant team. They essentially led that game from box to wire. No, they got the opportune turnovers, and you talk about it all the time, that all turnovers aren't created equally. And for Kansas City, they turned it over twice inside the 30 on their opening two possessions. I believe the next one, the Clyde Edwards-Helaire fumble, was also in plus territory. But again, when we look at football in this day and age, you see coaches like David Culley on Thursday night who elect to punt in plus territory, which makes absolutely no sense. You get the ball rammed down your throat and the game is over. And then you get the exact opposite. Brandon Staley on 4th and 4 in windy conditions has a chance for what would have been probably a very difficult field goal for the Chargers late in that game, elects to go for it on 4th and 4. And people are blown away by some of this decision making. I mean, you and I were texting, and we'll get to the Raiders and Dolphins in a moment, but you have to play to win the game. And if you have a franchise quarterback, put the ball in his hands and allow him to go out there and make a play. I know it was a pass interference flag that I think you and I are both still trying to find the replay on, but you give your team a chance rather than punting the ball back to Mahomes or attempting a long field goal that essentially a miss at that juncture of the game from the yard line where Kansas City would have started the possession. It was game over. So you may as well try and win it with your offense on the field.
And nobody on earth respects and loves playing to win more than me. Seeing Brandon Staley be really, really aggressive was awesome. Now, I know the math said on 4th and 4, the Chargers actually had a 3.5% better chance to win had they attempted the field goal. But then obviously you get the 5-yard penalty and it's 4th and 9. And that win rate increased to nearly 5.5% had they kicked the field goal. Now, here's what the computer doesn't tell you. There's 20-mile-per-hour steady winds, gusts up to 38 miles per hour in that game. And my point in saying that is the wind made Brandon Staley's decision. It wasn't one that took a bunch of stones, in my opinion. Kicker had already missed a PAT. With the wind, going for it was the only decision. You're not going to line up there and attempt a 50-plus yarder. I mean, only Brett Bielema punts from the opponent's 34. And the one thing we said coming into the game was it's a lot harder being a head coach than defensive coordinator, right? The play isn't over when you're a head coach. And so there's still a lot to think about game theory wise. And so I came away saying I thought Brandon Staley was horrific on first and goal. That's not a game where you have first and goal with 40 seconds left and somehow the Chiefs have zero timeouts and Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid get that ball back with the chance to win. So I thought there was horrific clock management late in that game. And again, going back to like the negative variance, and it's all over the internet, you had former referees come out and say, like, watch that Hail Mary. And I get that it's one of those situations where it's like a fourth quarter tie ball game in the NBA. Like, we're not calling fouls. Travis Kelce was tackled. It was like a clear pass interference. And I believe it was Terry McCauley that came out and was like, yeah, that was a pass interference. So just a lot of weird things going on with the Chiefs early on. It just feels like a shitstorm of negative variance that I think ultimately will flip here pretty quickly.
And you wonder what the market will show for that. I think everyone now talking about how the Chiefs are quote unquote unbettable going 2-12 against the spread the last 14 games. Yep. It's amazing to see that caliber of a high powered offense be deemed in that unbettable category. Like you mentioned, regression can be a monster both in the positive and negative manner. So we'll see exactly when it takes hold.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
If you're a referee, fourth and nine pass interference. They treated Jalen Guyton like he was Michael Jordan.
I still want to watch
they
that
made
play
sure
again.
Not to show that replay again. That
I was going to say Romo and Nance kind of glossed over it. We didn't get a replay of everything in this day and age. You know, seven or eight different angles, and on the most pivotal pass interference call of the entire game, we get nothing.
Nada. Zip.
So, it always leaves you to wonder. Either way, the Chargers, from an ATS standpoint, box to wire, were able to cover that football game, but I think there'll be opportunities to bet Kansas City going forward. Payne, in your soccer heyday, would you have been able to make a 66-yard field goal like Justin Tucker banging it off the upright against the Detroit Lions?
No, but I was a big fan of that kick. Teasers won, Lions plus the points won. Justin Tucker's the best. Like, he's the one guy in that situation where you're like, he's actually got a chance to bang this thing home. And this situation's actually an upgrade for him, right? Like, who expects him to make a 66-yarder? So all of a sudden, the pressure's not there. Like, a 49-yarder, that's got some pressure. 66-yarder, there's no pressure. And it's an upgrade for him. Like, he's kicking in turf. He's kicking in a dome compared to what he deals with in Baltimore. He's the best kicker in the NFL history. And now he's just adding to that. We've seen kickers with big legs. We've seen kickers that are, you know, deadly accurate. Justin Tucker's both. And if you had some teasers or if you used Baltimore in Survivor contests, you're probably a pretty big fan of Justin Tucker today.
Incredible. I mean, to watch that game unfold, we can say what we want about the extra 2 seconds Lamar Jackson was probably given the play before to get into field goal range. But if there's one franchise where you expect those kind of things to happen in late game situations, it's definitely the Detroit Lions, who, to their credit, have at least shown a ton of fight and tenacity through the first three games as they've gone 2-1 against the spread despite an 0-3 record, but a much more manageable foe this weekend when they'll head to Soldier Field to take on the Chicago Bears. Anything else in the good category that you wanted to try and highlight before we kind of segue into some of the bad and the ugly that unfolded over the week? And
let's talk about your boy, Kirk Cousins. I think he has been quietly one of the best quarterbacks through the early part of the season. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that's playing better than him. It's kind of a pivotal year. I mean, he watched the organization attempt to draft his replacement. I don't know if that will ultimately the way they expected it.
I don't know if Kirk's feeling a whole lot of pressure for anybody that watched Kellen Mond or Jake Browning during the preseason.
That is very true. He was really good early on in that game, and he had to be. He kind of kept them in it because the defense was terrible. Cousins came out, averaged 8 yards per pass attempt with a 69% success rate through the air, 5 explosives. Completion percentage was 6% above expectation. He kept Minnesota in it early, and then that allowed Zimmer to kind of make some halftime adjustments, and he did that. Terrible game plan, apparently. Fantastic halftime adjustment. Seattle had over 300 yards in the first half. 9.3 yards per play and a 64% success rate in the first half. Cousins matched it. And then all of a sudden, Zimmer had some time to figure some things out. 81 yards and 4.3 a play for Seattle's offense in the second half. This is a Vikings team that obviously our listeners know we were a little bit high on coming into the season, went over their win total at 8.5. They threw up all over themselves against Cincinnati, should have won that game in overtime before your horse, Dalvin Cook, fumbles. Week two, you go on the road, you miss a layup field goal to win it at Arizona as a dog. You can make the case Minnesota should be 3-0 right now.
No, I'm not even, I don't think it's even that big a reach of a case to say that the Vikings should be 3-0. I mean, this team has shown every bit of offensive firepower that you want to see. 87 points through three games is the most dynamic Vikings offense we've seen since 2009. And they did it yesterday without Dalvin Cook. We saw Alexander Mattison go bonkers. But it's also the second straight game that Seattle's offense, Payne, has really bogged down. And I wonder if that provides the perfect segue into trying to talk about the bad. And this is a Seahawks team who's now blown back-to-back double-digit leads. They haven't made the adjustments at the break, and you begin to wonder how long Russell Wilson can pull this shoddy defense along before all that late-game variance we've talked about for years finally catches up to the Seahawks and they become a 7-win football team.
When you look at Seattle, what they're doing offensively right now is they come out of the gates pretty strong. You have a brand new OC. It doesn't look like he has been able to adapt or adjust to what the defense is countering with in the later stages of the game. And you're also looking at an offense that's just living and dying on the explosive play right now. We also have to check on the Lockett injury, but not a lot of down-to-down success for Seattle. It's just been a ton of explosiveness through the air. The defense that we knew had some question marks coming in that we said, hey, on paper, metrically, just looking how they're built, probably at best an average type of defense. The one area where they were typically very good at in recent years was against the run. Not the best there right now either, but again, small sample size. It's just not quite clicking for Seattle. I think we've kind of been waiting for this downturn to happen. We saw it towards the end of last season. We thought the offensive adjustments would change a little bit with the short passing game going a little bit more tempo. Just haven't quite seen the adjustments from a young offensive coordinator to this point.
You know who also might have seen it coming? Russell Wilson, when he demanded a trade and tried to get out of town this offseason before the roof of the house completely caved in. But of course, we'll keep tabs on what Seattle does going forward. A massive game for them within the NFC West race this weekend, where they'll go on the road as short underdogs against the 49ers. Payne, you want to take the low-hanging fruit and continue to eviscerate this so-called elite Washington football defensive unit?
Yeah, you know, I think we can be quick here. I don't really want to beat a dead horse or pat ourselves on the back, but I think we pegged this pretty early on, and it's that Washington's defense isn't as good as advertised. They played a really, really poor schedule of offenses and quarterbacks last season. Josh Allen, he's back, apparently. My goodness, the Bills went up and down the field yesterday, almost 500 yards of offense in the wind, and that's why that total came down. I almost got cute. I should have got cute. We're contemplating when it flickered 44.5 to buy the hook and go over the key of 44 and just obviously didn't sack up there. Buffalo was really balanced yesterday. And that's kind of the one thing that interests me with Buffalo this year is based upon where they play games, based upon late in the season, all of the other teams that they'll be competing with have a little bit of a ground game. Buffalo did not in previous seasons. And now it feels like it's a little bit better. But the key is through the air, right? I mean, 8.2 yards an attempt from Josh Allen yesterday in the win. Completion percentage 9% above expectation. 4 explosive passes. It looks like him and Emmanuel Sanders are now on the same page. But going back to the ground game, 52% success rate. We saw some explosives against Miami the week prior. But what is truly concerning is Washington's defense had 9 days to prepare for Buffalo. The defense was called out by its coaching staff, and I don't really think that was the response we were looking for from Washington's defense.
Yeah, there was no preparation. I'm not sure what went on there whatsoever because they couldn't get pressure. They had chances to swing the momentum early in that game. The offense may not have done them any favors, but it's now four straight games that Washington has seen that stop unit get absolutely shredded, and you wonder if they can get right this weekend against Atlanta or if things will continue to head down a dark path. But for all the trials and tribulations of Washington defensively, I think those paled in comparison, Payne, to what we saw unfold in Cleveland in the Justin Fields debut.
I have to be honest. We downloaded all the stuff overnight and you wake up in the morning and it's done and you're looking at it and you see that box score pop up and I'm like, I may have to run this again because something clearly is not right here. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but there's just some really basic things. Matt Nagy isn't good. Chicago might have arguably the worst offensive line in football. And I think we mentioned Joe Woods' ability as a defensive coordinator to scheme number one receivers out of the game. And Allen Robinson's really the only weapon Chicago has. The market told you what was going to transpire here, right? The Browns were a 7.5-point favorite. We saw one of the largest moves of the entire week on the under. Nothing indicated that the Bears would have success here. Now, again, I had to do a double take looking at this advanced box score. 1.1 yards per play, a 14% passing success rate.
Dynamic.
Justin Fields' completion percentage, 28% below expectation. He was pressured on 53% of his dropbacks. However, even when he was kept clean, his adjusted completion percentage was 31%. This isn't the preseason. Teams actually get to prepare for you. It is only one game, so I wouldn't quite panic yet. But the knock on Justin Fields in college was he was a one-read quarterback. And that is just not going to work in the NFL, no matter how athletic or mobile you are.
The amazing part of all of that, and again, I'm not here to root for anyone's failure. I want to see all these rookies have a tremendous amount of success when they go from college to the pros. But the irony in the Bears drafting Justin Fields, given what they went through in the Mitchell Trubisky experience, the number one complaint Bears fans had, and some of the scouts out there, that Mitchell Trubisky was a one-read quarterback. So what do? You go out there and you get yourself another one-read quarterback who couldn't throw receivers open during his time at Ohio State, and you look at Justin Fields, and again, hey, look, I might be overly critical. The only games where he really struggled were the ones he was tested by elite level defensive schemes, whether it was Northwestern, whether it was in the college football playoff, and when Olave and Wilson didn't have 13 yards of separation working in their favor. It's a lot different in the National Football League. We'll see if he can learn, evolve, and adapt, but I'm not all that optimistic, especially when you're trying to do all this behind, like you mentioned, the worst offensive line in the NFL.
It's going to be interesting to see. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's still plenty of time to rectify this. And what was it? 47 total yards of offense. There's only one direction to go. But I do think it does become a little interesting here with Justin Fields in his potential maturation moving forward. Do we see a situation where he's now having to learn a brand new scheme potentially in year two? Let's just see what this looks like. We know he's mobile. We know he's athletic. He showed up big time in some big games. Let's give this a chance to see what it looks like, but obviously not a good first impression. Now, that's a Browns defense that we really like. I think they're going to be one of the better units when the dust settles this season. I truly believe that. I'm a Joe Woods guy. You revamped the secondary, you added some pieces at linebacker, you went out, got another pass rusher, added some things to the middle of the interior of the defensive line. I like how that defense is built for the Browns. So this wasn't going to be a positive situation for Chicago's offense to begin with, but that was really ugly. I mean, that was, if you threw out a MAC college football team, I would have bet that they would have been able to get 47 yards in this game.
Don't sleep on Dustin Crum, the star quarterback at Kent State. When you look at some of the other things that went south and did so quickly on Sunday, what would fall into the bad category before we get into the ugly department? And you don't have to pick on the Steelers yet. We'll get to them in a moment.
Well, I want you to go with this because I see on the sheet here you have the Dolphins' complete performance as the bad. So I will let you have your say, and then I will counter what you have to say.
Well, here's my take on it. And again, the dynamics in this game change. But when you look at what Miami was able to do or unable to do, at least through the first three quarters, I mean, this is a team that averaged 4 yards per play, 157 total yards of offense. The first touchdown came on a pick six of Derek Carr when you're talking about Landon Roberts streaking down the sidelines. The Dolphins' defense, to their credit, gets a stop when the Raiders elect to go for it in their own territory on fourth and one. They turn that into a 34-yard touchdown. But for the most part, I mean, the Dolphins were unable to get out of their own way. I mean, they couldn't convert fourth downs. They hadn't been able to all season until the final drive. Hat tip to them for getting all of our loyal listeners to the window, you and I included, although, of course, we would have loved to cash the money line tickets as well. But they couldn't get out of some of their man concepts on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, second and 20 turned into a touchdown. I believe it was to Hunter Renfrow when the Raiders went up 25-14. They couldn't get off the field on third and 13. I don't know if it's a talent issue, if it's scheme. The Dolphins went out there and fought, and they had a chance to win that football game. But to be honest, I was not all that impressed with what they brought on either the offensive or defensive side of the ball.
Defensively, that's the one thing we discussed coming into the season, that we thought the defense was a little overrated. You still don't have a natural pass rusher. You have to bring the blitz to get after the quarterback. And we know that's where Derek Carr is very good. And like you, I'm watching that and saying to myself, I understand Waller's an animal, but what did we pay Jones here? Like, if Jones can't cover a tight end, what are we doing? Xavien Howard, who is a guy that I really like, but I think there is a misconception of what he is as a true cover corner versus the plays he makes. I mean, he is an absolute ball hawk. The ball just finds him. He's got a nose for it. But in terms of, if you told me, hey, who's the best corner right now that can just like man up and remove a receiver from this game in coverage, he's not it. And you mentioned the big plays before the half. It's a jump ball to Henry Ruggs, which leads to points before the break, the momentum score. And he gets just out-jumped by Henry Ruggs. You mentioned the Hunter Renfrow touchdown. That's a 3rd and 9. The ball is thrown 4 yards short of the sticks. Hunter Renfrow turns Xavien Howard into a pretzel. And so those were like the little annoying things. Now, offensively, I didn't expect an explosion here.
No.
The total was, you know, 44-45. Throughout pretty much the entire week. You have a Jacoby Brissett who has a much slower release and wants to push the ball downfield a little bit more, playing an offense designed for Tua, who's a quick release, short pass quarterback. The possessions in the first half, the Dolphins had 5, because you mentioned, right, the back-to-back offensive possessions the Raiders had due to the pick six. And then one of the 5 possessions the Dolphins had only was one play because you gave up a safety. And that really is what woke the Raiders up. Like, they were just dead and buried. There was a little fight that ensued on the punt that woke the Raiders up. Then the first play is a safety. So there wasn't going to be a ton of production on 4 real drives. Most teams, just for reference, average about 12 and a half a game. But what's frustrating to me, and it's more of a general thing, Brian Flores is solid. I think he's changed the culture. He's obviously tough-nosed. He's not going to let guys run over him. He's going to hold players accountable, which I think is big when you have a professional team playing in Miami. The guys respect him. They've bought in. But where Flores has, I would say, flat-out failed is finding an offensive coordinator. He's had 3 different offensive coordinators in 3 years. He brought in Chad O'Shea from New England, who was a receivers coach over there his first year. All the players bitched that the scheme was too complex. He wasn't happy that O'Shea thought he had Tom Brady at quarterback and there's going to be a lot of checks and just intricate things within an offense, and it was just too complicated for the young guys. Then last year, he goes the complete opposite direction and hired 69-year-old Chan Gailey, and his offense was super antiquated, far too much running. He's gone. This was the year to like go and find a guy that you didn't have to worry about, and instead he promoted within. He named co-offensive coordinators George Godsey and Eric Studsville. Neither of them knew who was calling plays until a week before the season. And Flores ultimately decided to go with Studsville, who is a running backs coach. And so when you look at this game, it was really frustrating for me to watch. There was a stretch from the 11-minute mark of the second quarter to the 4-minute mark of the third quarter where the Dolphins had trips to the Raiders 39, 30, 48, 23, and 43. Those five trips ended with three total points. And it's because Studsville would get down there and get too conservative. There was a stretch before the half where you are leading. I believe it's 14-5 at this point. Or maybe it's 14-12. I can't quite remember. And you have first and 10 from the Raiders 39. You can take back the momentum. And Studsville goes run, run, third and 9, screen pass behind the line of scrimmage. And so I just didn't get it. It was way too conservative. And then the opposite of Brandon Staley, right? We watched Flores yesterday have a 4th and 1.5 in overtime.
I was going to ask you about that. So I'm glad you hit on that.
With 2 minutes to go. And he's getting excited about having a chance to tie the game. That was the Dolphins' best result in overtime. A chance to go back home with a tie. And, you know, that only happens if your kicker bangs home a 50-yarder. And it was just very conservative across the board yesterday.
Be interesting to see. A pivotal game for two teams. A reeling Colts team comes into South Florida next weekend at 0-3. The Dolphins a chance to get back to 500 as their modest home favorites in that particular contest. And for me, Payne, when it comes to the ugly, I mean, I have to start right inside my own house with the Pittsburgh Steelers offense. Can there be anything done for this team to salvage its season? I mean, they picked up 161 of their 342 total yards of offense on two drives when they were already down three scores in that contest. You haven't been able to move the ball each of the last 2 weeks against the Raiders and Bengals. I'm not sure this gets any better for Pittsburgh, especially if they're going to be down a couple cogs in their receiving core.
It doesn't, you know? How can it be? It can at this point because you don't have anything there. Who's your quarterback? It's Big Ben, who's injured, can't push the ball down the field. Your offensive line's abysmal, so you can't get anything going in the ground game. It's basically Najee Harris catching balls out of the backfield, short balls. And we saw Matt Canada basically say, hey, I think I might have to go back to the Randy Fichtner offense. There really isn't another choice because you can't run the ball and Big Ben can't really throw it deep. So you are resorting to a bunch of short passes. And so there's just not much room here for improvement. I don't know where you go offensively. And the real problem is that your defense is a little beaten and banged up right now. But if you look through the first three quarters of that game, Pittsburgh's offense, 189 total yards, 3.9 yards per play, a 33% success rate overall. Could not run the ball the first three quarters. I mean, 20% rushing success rate. There's just not a lot here on offense. And this is the reason that when we did our preview podcast, this is the reason odds makers didn't believe in this team. We didn't believe in this team. 8.2 wins is where the market closed on their win total. That tells you they were a below average team coming into the season. And now you have the injuries on the defensive side of the ball. This is who they are. They might actually be worse than a team that's projected to win 8 games. I mean, we kind of called it, and I know like there's a lot of people that are like, you know, guys that who talk now on podcasts who wouldn't look at analytics, who kind of balked at EPA and efficiency and all that, have suddenly turned into like analytics mavens now on their podcasts. We're the like, same, win probability. Pittsburgh had a great win probability in the first game in Buffalo. And it's like, that's fine. You're not going to block a punt for a touchdown every game. You're not going to win games on the road throwing for 188 yards and having 233 yards of total offense in a game. You're not going to do that week to week. And this is what we're seeing here. I mean, this offense is bad. And you're still waiting for the other weapons. Like, you know, I think there's this... We're all enamored by Juju Smith-Schuster. Guy's fantastic on TikTok. Not a great receiver, just an okay receiver. We're still looking for Chase Claypool to kind of take that next step and emerge as a true number one, which I don't think he is at this point. And what else do you have? You have Najee Harris, who he's actually better than I thought he was. He's just poor kid, has nothing to run in front of. That offensive line's horrific again.
Just throw him the ball 15 times a game. I'm perfectly fine with that.
There you go. Just catch it. PPR league. 1 point a pop.
It's definitely a tough watch. And you know what? And I'm not sure this is an apropos comparison, but when I watch the Steelers on Sunday, they remind me an awful lot of a college football team that has the exact same colors that plays on Saturday that people have bought into as a national title contender in the Iowa Hawkeyes, where it's all defense. You just hope the offense can do enough to get you where you need to go. And I think it's going to be a long season in Pittsburgh because, unlike the Big Ten, there are teams in the National Football League that can score more than 21 points a game to go out there and put a little bit of pressure on your defense. So, not sure that there is a silver lining for the men in the Steel City this football season. Before we go on to look ahead lines, wanted to make sure we covered enough of the landscape as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly were concerned. So was there anything else that stood out to you that you felt like hitting on this fine morning?
You know, I think we need to look, because it'll be a game that we probably discussed Thursday, but we can kind of get there briefly. We're still seeing an offense in Jacksonville that's just ugly right now. And I actually thought that Trevor Lawrence played his best game of the season. He looked pretty good. Completion percentage was above expectation for the first time all year. 53% passing success rate. The mistakes are hurting him, right? The first interception wasn't on him. Receiver should have caught it. Gets bobbled. The second interception's as bad as it gets, and it happens right before the fourth quarter. So you lose all the momentum heading into the money quarter. But just offensively, what Jacksonville is doing right now doesn't leave you with a lot of confidence at all. I mean, Urban Meyer, I don't know how long this is going to last.
And week eight, week nine, when does USC make it official if they can try and lure Urban in?
I had some reservations coming into the season just because we saw how things ended his last few years. And it wasn't just like the way in which he left with some of the issues off the field and whatnot, but you saw the offense kind of gradually, like, just take a step back a little bit, I felt like. And I wasn't quite sure a lot of his issues would work in the NFL. Like, it was just simply having to, like, out-athlete other teams. And you're not going to do that in the NFL. So, it doesn't feel like a very complex offense. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of sophistication going on, and he's probably not putting guys in the best positions to succeed. And his poker face is just terrible as well. I mean, a lot of coaches, I admire coaches, and because I know I wouldn't be able to do it, but I admire coaches that you have no idea if the team's up 30 or down 30. And Urban Meyer's living and dying on every field goal. I mean, his team misses a field goal, and he's just out there just hands on the knees, like hats coming off, throwing the hands up. It's like, you've been a coach for 40 years. Get it figured out emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, there comes a time and a place where you have to keep that poker face. You have to keep that even keel disposition if you're going to succeed at this level. And let's see exactly if Urban's able to right the ship. As you mentioned, a game coming into the year that you thought was going to be somewhat winnable on paper Thursday night doesn't look to be quite that way, as we transition from the good, the bad, and the ugly to the look ahead lines. But it's also the perfect time to remind you to follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And Payne, in the wake of the Bengals' dominant performance against the Steelers, the Jaguars failing to meet oddsmakers' expectations against Arizona, you've seen this number go through a key number at FanDuel Sportsbook from 6.5 out to 7.5.
Yeah. I mean, when's the last time the Bengals have been favored by more than a touchdown in a game? I don't know off the top of my head, but it's probably a very rare occurrence. And I don't know, it's probably a game we'll break down a little bit more on Thursday. I think this is probably a game that makes the cut. I know some of our listeners voted out last Thursday's game, but then we got some pullback from some others. Like, how can we not break down Thursday night football? There's a lot of good games on Sunday, too. So I'm not sure if we leave this one off the card. But I think ultimately we're looking at Joe Burrow getting a little bit more acclimated to things. Looks a little bit healthier. He's stepping into balls. Him and Ja'Marr Chase seem to be completely on the same page. The defense, which we thought would be a little bit better this season just based on all the money they had spent in the past two off seasons, is coming to fruition a little bit. And I think the one thing that we've always seen is not only does the home team have a little bit of an advantage on Thursdays, but you have a young quarterback with a new system still fairly early in the season going out on a short week. If you can't really do what you wanted to do with a full offseason, what are you going to come up with here on a short week? And I think that's where things get a little bit difficult.
Yeah, a battle that will pit the last two number one overall picks in the draft there. Clearly a common denominator. Joe Burrow is ties to Ohio State as well. Don't think for a second from a motivational standpoint that'll be lost on the man who was able to achieve college football immortality with his time at LSU, not necessarily in Columbus. No. Payne, this number doesn't surprise me. It probably won't surprise a lot of our listeners. The Bears-Lions game, look ahead, had the Bears as a six-point favorite at FanDuel Sportsbook. This number is all the way down a full field goal to Chicago minus three.
Yeah, there's, you know, you don't want to overreact to like 1 week's performance, and we'll obviously see a little bit better version of Justin Fields in this game. But I think this is as much as Chicago's really horrific performance and what would look like a downgraded quarterback as it is the Detroit Lions being somewhat competitive. Obviously, didn't show well early on in the 49ers game, but showed fight, which is kind of the mantra of its head coach. Came back, battled back, didn't sulk, fought back, covered some numbers on the back door in week one had you gotten the Lions at post. Week two, against the Packers, go out there. You're leading at halftime on the road. And then all of a sudden, the rainy weather hits and Goff kind of turns into a pumpkin and, you know, you throw that game away. But fought back again yesterday against Baltimore. Should have won the game outright as an 8-point dog. So, again, Chicago's a mess right now, but this is like this multifaceted. Chicago's down. Detroit's really fighting. They're probably smelling the first win when you look at Justin Fields and the Chicago Bears. And this is a very winnable game for them. And so that's what you're seeing with this adjustment.
First time in four games this season that the Lions will play a team that was not listed as a preseason favorite to win their division. So you want to talk about punching above their weight class. That's what the Lions were forced to do the first 3 weeks. Let's see how they handle the level of familiarity against the Chicago Bears. Modest move here, Payne, but through one of the key numbers, you saw the Saints look ahead price at -6.5 at FanDuel Sportsbook. They'll welcome in the New York Giants on Sunday afternoon. This number out to 8 in the wake of the Giants starting the season 0-3 and the Saints looking a lot more like the team that dismantled the Green Bay Packers week one than the team that was beat up by Carolina week two in their win over New England.
Yeah, I think New England's defense yesterday was a little bit kind of how I expected it, right? They played Zach Wilson and Tua the first 2 weeks and now they got a decent offense. Now, huge game-changing plays before the break and out of the half for the Saints. It looked like Jameis was about to implode there right before the break and did one of his little whirly-derves into the back of the end zone, and Callaway came up and caught it, and then you had the pick six out of the break where the receiver just drops the ball and there's a pick six. So I think yesterday's score was potentially a little misleading. But, you know, you have a situation here where now we're asking Jameis and the Saints to cover an 8.5 number in a game with a total of 43.5, and the Giants are going to be a little bit desperate here. They did piss yesterday's game away, up 14-7 late. We do want to monitor some of the injury situations for the weapons for the Giants. We saw Sterling Shepard leave. I believe it was with a hamstring. We saw Slayton leave. I think that was with a concussion. We'll have to double check on those two weapons. Feels a touch high at this point, but ultimately, a game that we haven't looked into too much as we sit here Monday, 8 a.m. Pacific time.
Last but not least, a modest move, not through any key numbers, more in the teaser window than anything else. Look ahead price had the Baltimore Ravens, a 1.5-point road favorite for their trip to the Mile High City to take on Denver. You now see Denver as a 1.5-point favorite. The Broncos have started the season 3-0 straight up, 3-0 against the spread, but obviously major questions about who the Broncos have beaten when they're the Kings of New York and their third win came against the Jacksonville Jaguars.
This will be the huge test for Denver. We knew they could start the season 3-0 just based on the schedule. We do have the slight move here through zero. I don't have it in front of me. Any idea, and I don't want to put you on the spot, any idea what this number was before the season?
Before the season, I do not, but I'm inclined to believe that it was the Ravens -3. I'll have to try and track it down.
That was the vibe that I would have got. So we do have about a 4-point adjustment from what these two teams were prior to the season. Baltimore is obviously still beaten and banged up. I think we'll see a little bit more of a game effort from Baltimore here. Just, you know, huge Super Bowl-like win against the Chiefs. It was always going to be a little bit of a tough turnaround to then go and play in Detroit against the Lions. I think we'll see a little more engagement here, but ultimately this is Denver's, like, prove it, we're for real type game. Vic Fangio, who we respect the heck out of, is probably going to give Baltimore some looks that they have not seen to date. We know he likes to go with a little bit more of a faster defense on the field with an extra member of the secondary. That typically is bode well against Lamar Jackson and the Ravens. So we'll see what comes of it. Not a massive move from week to week through the zero, but certainly a substantial move from what this was prior to the season.
Tell you one thing, at first blush, I know everyone will pay attention to Sunday Night Football with Tom Brady's homecoming to Gillette, but I think from a football standpoint, this is the most fascinating game of the week, and I'm curious to see how it gets bet throughout the week as we're trying to figure out exactly what the Broncos are in the eyes of the betting market. Of course, a team that you mentioned we were high on coming into the season, as I know all of our listeners are holding a win total ticket over 8.5. This would go a long way if we can get out of the gates with a 4-0 start. Speaking of win totals, a perfect spot to place all of your action. Of course, not win totals at this juncture, but week to week, college football, pro football, and the Major League Baseball playoffs that are right on the horizon. FanDuel.com/bet the board. Take advantage of all the new user signups, the promotions they have there, and of course, just in time for Monday Night Football, enhanced odds of 30-1 on the Eagles and Cowboys tonight for new users. Be sure to read the rules and regulations, but FanDuel has you covered. Speaking of which, Payne, Eagles and Cowboys, NFC East showdown. These two proud franchises have combined to win a bevy of division titles when you look at the longstanding history between them. 31 of 50 since the division was formed back in 1970. The first Monday Night Football meeting between these two teams since 2008. I feel like every year it's played on Sunday night instead with Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth on the call. You're looking at the Cowboys now, a 3-point favorite. You do have to lay a $1.20 total, and this game sits at 51.5 at FanDuel Sportsbook. Cowboys have lost 7 straight in primetime. They broke a string of 6 failed covers during that span with their season opening loss against Tampa Bay coming up just short there. Cowboys, of course, playing the home opener, and this an Eagles team a little bit more banged up coming into this game than what we saw last week against the 49ers when we backed them as 3-point home underdogs.
Yes, they are a little bit more banged up. Some of it comes along the offensive line with the left tackle situation and Brandon Brooks out as well. Let's see what Nick Sirianni comes up with tonight. You know, the game plan against Atlanta was get the ball out quick, right? Get receivers into the game, let them make, you know, run after the catch plays. Hurts intended air yards week one, 3.7, lowest in the league. And then week two, Sirianni's like, let's bomb that sucker. And Hurts intended air yards were 14.6, most in the league. There needs to be some kind of marrying of the first 2 weeks here. Like, you can't not threaten a defense deep and, you know, neglect intermediate passes as well. There kind of needs to be a little happiness between those two philosophies. My gut says that Philly's offense is going to have some variance from week to week. It's an offense that's really going to be predicated on, like, the scheme, and I'm all about scheming for opponent. You should always do that. But it just feels like if a team makes the Eagles and Jalen Hurts specifically play left-handed, so to speak, that they're going to have a hard time adjusting. Like, I'm looking at this now. Jalen Hurts has thrown one pass between the hash marks through two games. If you
Ryan Day would be very impressed by that approach with a young quarterback.
I mean, if you're going to, like, study defenses and where they're most vulnerable, it's over the middle. And then you just kind of add, like, the new NFL rules where you can't really hit anyone. The middle of the field provides opportunities the Eagles haven't taken advantage of yet. And maybe, you know, at this stage in Hurts' development, they don't feel comfortable with him doing that. Because right now, everything's being made easy for him. Sirianni's having him throw really short, or it's one read deep throws. A lot of the offensive principles that Sirianni's using are from what he claims he saw Jalen Hurts best at executing with the Sooners and Lincoln Riley. So you just don't really know what we're going to get game to game. Obviously, Dallas's defense is dropping down in weight class here. You face Tom Brady and Justin Herbert the first 2 weeks. I'm also having a hard time gauging what the Cowboys defense actually is. I came into the season thinking that they'd be below average, and they are. They're perfectly below average right now, but they've also dealt with a rash of injuries, and they've played elite quarterbacks. So you'd think a little tiny uptick is coming, but they're also living on turnovers right now. Dan Quinn's defense has basically just been super opportunistic. 30% of opponent drives have ended in a turnover. That rate is impossible to sustain. So that's where I'm kind of struggling with what Dallas is defensively. Matchup-wise, I think when you watch this game, you're going to see Philadelphia use a bunch of 11 personnel. Three wide sets. They've lived in that, basically. 40% more 11 personnel than 12. That's a big change for them. Eagles out of that formation, 6.2 a carry from three wide sets. 70% rushing success rate. A lot of that is Jalen Hurts creating that extra man advantage in the box. Dallas defensively has struggled stopping the run from that formation. Allowed 5.4 a carry, 67% rushing success rate, defending 11 personnel runs. So schematically, there is a little bit of an edge here offensively for the Eagles. Although you just have two data points, a guy like DeMarcus Lawrence out for a game like this is huge. We know he's good getting after the quarterback, but he's really good setting the edge and containing things outside. That can be an issue. We could see some play action from Jalen Hurts tonight. He's been terrible doing it, which is odd. But let's see if Sirianni dials that up, because Dan Quinn defenses have been super susceptible to that over the years. I could see Philly throwing on early downs if they're smart. Dan Quinn has some tendencies he should probably try and break. But very low blitz rate on early downs in Atlanta. So, of course, the Cowboys' blitz rate is well below average on first down as well. It's really above average on third down. So I think, again, throwing on early downs would be smarter for Sirianni to kind of keep Jalen Hurts comfortable. Dallas didn't blitz Herbert a single time on first down last week. When you think about Philly being without its left tackle, Jordan Mailata, and then again, Brandon Brooks is also out at guard, probably makes sense to throw on early downs as well to avoid the late Dan Quinn blitzes on third, get the ball out quick, let receivers and running backs make plays against Dallas's defense. Right now, Dallas is 26th in team tackling grade. So, like, get the ball out, right? Just let those guys make plays. Randy Gregory's back tonight. That's a positive, I guess, for Dallas's defense. You still have a couple depth guys out along the line in Armstrong and Watkins. I would assume that Quinn is going to keep Parsons at defensive end in this wild boar role. Parsons is really quick, right? Registered 8 pressures last week against the Chargers. The other fun matchup to look for here is the Bama guys going at each other, Devontae Smith and Trayvon Diggs. Diggs has started pretty well. He's been targeted 14 times on 101 coverage snaps, only allowing a 43 passer rating on those targets. Devontae Smith is the clear-cut number one. 25% target share week one, 29% target share week two. But because the passing game wasn't very controlled against San Francisco, only 2 of the 7 targets Smith caught, and only 2 of the 7 were actually deemed catchable. So I think you want to get him involved in the game a little bit early on, not necessarily on like 50-yard deep routes. Just get him submerged into the game early, and I think you might have some success offensively here for Philly.
When you look at things unfolding on the other side of the ball, of course, this is Dallas's strength. We've seen them use 2 backs to start the season. Tony Pollard, of course, going over 100 yards. And you don't put me in the camp of folks that think he's ready to be a lead back, because Ezekiel Elliott, still a better receiver, in my opinion, and blocker in terms of operating from that position. Dak Prescott, of course, not going to have his full complement of weapons. Michael Gallup put on short-term IR. Amari Cooper will be out there, but he's extremely banged up. When you look at the Eagles defense so far this season, Payne, they've allowed just 2 touchdowns on 20 drives, but they haven't really played what I would deem to be elite caliber offensive units like they're going to see here. Yes, San Francisco is above average, but they were sleepwalking at least early on in that game, and the Falcons, well, the Falcons are still the Falcons.
Zeke is a good blocker. Do you think fantasy owners are going to their commissioner in the league and saying, hey man, we'd like to add a PPR point for blocking?
Fantasy owners are probably not real happy with Zeke's usage in terms of his real football world potential versus what he's doing to accumulate statistics.
The weird part is he's in like really good shape too. So this feels like we're potentially on the downtick here of his career, which is
durability. Keep him fresh,
right?
Keep him fresh.
I'm always interested to see what Jonathan Gannon comes up with defensively. He is, to me, really good at what he does, and I think he was the hidden gem in Indianapolis, and he did far more than the job title suggested. And it's pretty clear the Colts defense has missed him through 3 weeks. Now, unless Gannon keeps coming up with game plans that are winners every week, we'll probably see the Eagles defense regress from what they've done the first 2 weeks. And you hit this perfectly. It's that their secondary hasn't really been tested yet. They got Matt Ryan, who's learning a brand new system in week one, and Ryan's got the lowest completed air yards in the league through three games. Last week, it was Jimmy G still kind of searching for confidence, but also another dink and dunk short passing offense. The Eagles do get a little bit of a break tonight, right? No Gallup. Cooper's dealing with the rib issue. But, I mean, just when I look at this, it'll be interesting to see what Gannon does defensively, because through 2 weeks, he has kind of played back in coverage and made offenses just methodically move the ball. He's not a guy that sent a lot of blitz. Sent blitz 9% of Matt Ryan's dropbacks, a shade less than 8%. On Jimmy G's dropbacks. Opposing teams have tried to heat up Dak, right? They want to check his health. They want to see if he's mobile after the ankle injury. Dak's been pressured on 41% of his dropbacks. He's been blitzed at one of the league's highest rates. So seeing whether Gannon does something that he hasn't put on film or whether he kind of sits back, that'll be fun to me. You have Lael Collins out, obviously. Brandon Graham.
Lael Collins, by the way, he's my hero. He's my absolute hero. Not showing up for drug tests, bribing NFL drug officials. Lord only knows what that man's had going on. I applaud him for doing everything he can to stay on the field.
Let's see what comes of that situation. That'll be interesting.
I don't think it'll be good. Yeah. Call it a hunch, buddy. I don't think it'll be good.
Call it a hunch. So that's kind of what I'm intrigued about on this side of the ball. Like, what does Jonathan Gannon come up with schematically? The one area where Philly has been somewhat vulnerable through 2 weeks is on the ground, which is a little surprising. 18th in defensive rush efficiency. You wonder if San Fran put some things on tape that the Cowboys will mimic. If you're smart offensively, and you're trying to run on the Eagles, it's not up the middle of Fletcher Cox, right? The goal should be to get outside. So outside zone runs, sweeps, tosses, avoid running into Fletcher Cox, right? And get outside as quickly as you can. So I would expect Tony Pollard to continue having a larger role than I think we expected before the season. I mean, at this point, he is the guy that can get outside a little bit quicker. Small sample, working through just two games, but the Eagles' opponents, 63% rushing success rate on runs outside the left tackle, 56% rushing success rate on runs outside the right tackle. So I think those are a couple of things to look for tonight. Gannon's defense, is it going to hold up against the pass? Is he going to sit back in coverage, or is he going to blitz a little bit? Will he, you know, create more pressure situations? Will Dallas be smart with how they decide to run the football tonight? Those are just a couple of the things. When you get to the number, we're seeing a little bit of a battle here, because this game opened 3.5. We saw a group get out and lay it pretty early in the week, went to 4.5. Then we saw another well-respected bettor come in and grab the 4.5 on the dog. And now it's we haven't seen a bunch of playback. My gut says taking the 4.5 probably wins a little bit more than laying the 3.5 here, Todd. Just kind of based on what I have seen in handicapping this, and I kind of respect the second move and who made it as opposed to the first one.
It's very fair. We know all moves are not created equally in the betting market, especially around secondary key numbers in the National Football League. So going to be fascinating to see how this game transpires. I'll laugh my ass off if the game ends at 4 for those folks that lay 3 compared to those folks that took 4.5. It's rare to see a game where it just has one-way movement, although we did see it yesterday between the Steelers and Bengals. And of course, that game, the Bengals cover from box to wire. But important reminder, as always, as we try and make all you, our loyal listeners, a little bit sharper, a little bit smarter, whether it's your first season or your 40th doing this, it's all about the number, and the handicap changes significantly if you're taking 3 with the dog tonight versus the opportunity to take 4 or better where that move came in on Philadelphia. Any final words of wisdom, pain, pearls, or nuggets you'd like to share before we part ways for 48 hours?
No, I think that's everything. Wednesday college football. Yay.
I know you're excited. You can't hide your enthusiasm. Our listeners see right through that. And we do have a great slate of college football games. We'll see if we boil it down the way we've been doing it. If so, please check our Bet the Board Twitter feed and mine as well to try and see your voice heard as we try and identify the five biggest games to break down. For Pain Insider, you can follow him on Twitter at Pain Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Best of luck with all of your investments tonight on Monday Night Football between the Eagles and Cowboys, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.